This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. As promised, today's show is going to be part one of the Verizon data breach report from the beginning of 2017. So this actually covers the last 12 months or approximately thereof, the last 12 months of Verizon's risk team data breach report activities. Although they do say in their report that they are also including correlative data from the last 3 years, which is useful because then they are talking about how trends have changed over time, what scenarios exist that are new, same, getting less predominant, more predominant, these sorts of things. So my approach with my review of this, which, by the way, it's a very, very detailed 84-page document. I do strongly suggest that you read it if you so choose to. There's a tremendous amount to be learned from it. However, I think there's actually more to be learned from a combinatory approach of, yes, read the document, however, listen to my analysis of the document as well. Because I found as I was reading their report, I came up with quite a lot of commentary about how the things that they said needed a bit of interpretation. And so that's the value that I'm adding to this, is that interpretation that can help you really get to the more tangible meat and potatoes of that report, where you can then take that as actionable intelligence to find out, okay, so these people were breached based upon this attack vector. How does that relate to my environment? And am I already doing everything that I can to mitigate the risk from that type of a breach? Or are there things that we can do better? So again, my recommendation for you, and I'm going to do two shows on this because the data is so dense and yet it's so important, that in part one here, I'm basically going to start at the beginning of the document and we're going to talk about these breaches. And I'm going to give you the whole meat and potatoes sort of interpretation of it, is this is what the attack vector is, and this is what would have prevented that sort of an attack, and so that you can then assess for yourself, oh, well, we're already doing that, or we're doing part of that, or we're not doing it at all. And then that you can take that as an action item to back to your environment and correct that. And please keep in mind that when I'm talking about your environment, I'm even talking about environments where there's a single home user. I mean, I am serious with this stuff. Even a single home user needs a certain level of common sense security protocols in place. These items can, your level of adequate security can actually be achieved in a single user home environment with common sense best practices and standards. And yes, you do actually have to apply a little bit of money to it, because you do really need a perimeter security appliance. There's just no way to get around that fact. So let's get started. Verizon did a great job of overall categorizing what what those incidences were. And one of the fascinating things that they said at the beginning of this report was that their categorizations resulted in 12 scenarios that represented 60% of the breaches that their team was involved in investigating over the last 3 years. So 12 scenarios, 60% of investigations. What this then means is, by addressing those 12 scenarios in your environment, you can address 60% of the attack vectors. And I would argue that in some of these cases, you're going to be able to say to yourself, well, I don't have any point of sale equipment, so you can just, you know, notch that off of your list right away. Or I don't have any SCADA equipment, so just, again, notch that off of your list. Because if you don't have that equipment, then you're it's not possible to breach you through that vector when you don't have that equipment. So that means that by simply going through these 12 scenarios, you may even be able to close more than 60% of the security gaps in your environment. So let's get started with this. The first one that they were talking about had to do, and their report, I have to say, in the beginning is rather interesting. It's got some stuff about if you're in this particular type of an industry, this is what we typically find, such and such. Well, I'm not going to cover that because I don't really think that that's all that much valuable. What I have ultimately come with as a takeaway from this entire document is that if an organization was to follow the NIST SP800 cybersecurity standards and best practices, which has been published for the last 20 years, it's been updated. The techniques get updated. The techniques are obviously more advanced and sophisticated now, but the concepts are all exactly the same. And I didn't find anything in this document that was new to me. This is the items that are the mitigation controls that they talk about in this entire breach report are the mitigation controls that we at QPC have been using for our clientele for the last 16 years. So that means that it's completely attainable. And yes, by the way, we do the majority of these mitigation controls even in single user residential environments. So you don't have to be a big dog in the ballpark to be able to have these protections. Okay. So the first incident, they categorized it, or they called it social engineering. And what this basically was a chief design engineer was solicited via LinkedIn with it was supposed to be a job offer. And in reality, what it was a fake job offer that contained a like spear phishing attack that included an email with some PHP backdoor shell code in it. And of course, that did exactly what you would think it would do. You know, it downloaded a command and control channel, remote access Trojan, malware, and effectively turned his machine into a device that scanned the network for anything and everything that he, the lead engineer, had access to, and then packaged it up and then sent it to a server in China. So, you know, you look at something like this and you say, well, what could have stopped that? Well, first, GeoIP blocking definitely would have stopped that. And this is probably the first year that I can say that GeoIP blocking and GeoIP blocking techniques overall are truly accessible for everyone. In prior years, I could not have said that. So really, 2016 was the year of, and really in the later portions of 2016 was really where GeoIP blocking as a technology has become completely accessible, even in the smallest of environments. And what you'll find is that the whole GeoIP blocking concept keeps coming up over and over and over again as an effective technique. And I can even tell you from firsthand experience, there is, well, I can tell you right now, one of my servers is consistently under attack from a source in Antigua. But because I use GeoIP blocking, those packets never get through. So that's interesting, isn't it? And you have to say to yourself, well, if you weren't using GeoIP blocking, what would be happening then? You know, and here's the other thing. Would you even know that something untoward was happening if you didn't have GeoIP blocking? So these are the questions you have to ask yourself. Now, in this case of the phishing, the social engineering, and spear phishing here, the GeoIP blocking of traffic to locations that this network did not need to talk to would have actually stopped the command and control software from, or I should say malware, from delivering data back to China. So that definitely should be used. Other things could have been used, such as, why was this most important engineer in the company not using two different completely segmented systems? If I was the network admin responsible for setting up the environment for this engineer, I would literally have two completely different systems at that engineer's desk. And USB file transfer would be completely disabled on those systems, on both of them. So, and the engineer would have gone through training. You know, if I see you in here, or we find out that you've been using a USB connected device, you know, you're just going to be terminated immediately. Don't do it. And this secure system, you're only supposed to be doing your engineering job on it. This other system, you can do your email and your social networking and whatever else on it. And these things are on completely different networks with completely different security access controls. And on the less secure system, the engineer's user account would be completely different, and that user account would not have access to the places on the network where the secure engineering drawings were stored. And multi-factor authentication would be enabled on both accounts. So what that means is that credential theft attacks like Pass the Hash or Mimikatz or Golden Ticket attacks would not be a problem in that environment. So there are some pretty basic things that could have been done. And by the way, everything that I just told you is all completely standard operating procedure for any level of a secure environment where you just, and when I use the term secure environment, I'm talking about something that has the ability to access data that you actually care about. I'm not talking about banks here. I'm talking about just you care about the stuff that's there and you don't want it in the hands of your competitors or the bad guys, or you just want your computers to keep working properly as opposed to being broken by malware. Okay, so the other thing that really jumped out at me about this is, why wasn't there endpoint security product on this engineer's system that stopped the malware on his system from propagating? So was his user account an admin account? Why? If it was an admin account, it shouldn't have been. And certainly from any sort of a secure engineering computer, there shouldn't be email and web browsing and other things like that going on. I would have completely blocked access to social networking at work for that engineer. So, all right, let's move on to the next scenario, which is financial pretexting. And this was a scenario where a CFO or somebody in the, you know, higher level in the finance department indicated that her computer had been acting funny and it does things on its own sometimes. And there had been some unauthorized transfers that had gone on. And so the investigation revealed that there was a Zeus variant that was on her computer, and it, of course, had stolen her credentials and had scraped data. It had captured all the information that it needed in order to initiate fraudulent wire transfers from inside their network. So this was a matter where this person was sent a targeted spear phishing campaign. And my viewpoint on this is that targeted spear phishing can be defeated by most host-based security and network layer security protections that prevent the download of command and control malware and other types of malware, like advanced persistent threats. So the other thing is, even if those credentials were stolen, then multi-factor authentication would have also stopped that. Now, I do have to caveat that, though, that multi-factor authentication for banking in the United States tends to only work if it's sophisticated enough, which I don't see that being predominantly the case in most banks in the United States, which is rather shocking. So most banks are still using the whole silly validation picture or, oh, well, here's your other special keyword thing, you know, that kind of like silliness. So if you are responsible for banking for an organization that has a considerable sums of money, you may want to talk to your bank about getting in a bank account that has a special key fob token. Now, I know that if you do go to a bank and you say, look, I want to have hardened multi-factor authentication, they generally actually do have a mechanism for you to get it, but you're going to have to pay more. Now, my argument is, let's say that costs you $200 a year or less. Isn't that less of a cost to your organization than having the credentials for your banking breached, where now malicious wire transfers or fraudulent wire transfers are happening on? So, you know, got to think about that stuff. But I still continue to be rather strongly disappointed by most U.S. banks not offering a more sophisticated multi-factor authentication system, if any, for consumer banking or for small business banking, where it's just that's the default position, it's included, and by default, they have adequate security there. So, and I'm really strongly disappointed in most banks, because when I look at the Department of Revenue for the state of Wisconsin, they have a really good multi-factor authentication system in place that doesn't have anything to do with you paying for special tokens. They just use a system that forces you to have human presence, and it forces you to have another piece of the puzzle that isn't on that computer, and it's all generated in real time. So what that means is that this whole credential theft garbage is pretty strongly defeated by any, you know, in the case of anyone other than extremely sophisticated nation-state attackers, okay? So if the Wisconsin Department of Revenue can do it, you'd think that your bank could figure out how to do it. The next scenario is a digital extortion. And in this case, it was a matter of an e-commerce platform where the bad guys had gotten direct access to the entire database of hundreds of, well, 1.5 million customer orders, it says. Now, that's a lot of personally identifiable information, I'd say. 1.5 million customer orders. The bad guys got access to this entire database simply because the e-commerce platform was not using a proper web application firewall. So this again makes my head want to explode, because you can get a web application firewall for like less than $200 a year. You know, so you really have to ask the question, what level of incompetence were they suffering from to where they didn't have a web application firewall? I mean, I can't even begin to comprehend this idea of having an internet accessible website, especially one that's handling financial transactions and PII, personally identifiable information, for your customer base, and yet it doesn't have a web application firewall. Because we've known for the last 20 years, more than 20 years, about SQL injection attacks. We know that you can't have a website just accepting direct input manipulated URLs. There must be protections against those sorts of attacks and brute force attacks. There needs to be denial of service attack prevention, botnet. I mean, you know, you could just go on the whole thing, but it basically is all about whether or not you have a functional web application firewall. So where this is super, super relevant to all of you that have a small business out there where you have a website, or let's say you just, I don't know, you've got a blog or something, you really need to seriously ask yourself a question. Do I have a fully functional web application firewall that gets updated regularly? So if it's only going to cost like $200 a year to have a proper web application firewall, what's stopping you from having it? So the next one was about attacker hubris. And in this case, there was a guy who was bragging about how he used a SQL injection attack against a corporate website to then gain remote RDP, remote shell access through RDP port 3389 to reach literally every system in the environment. The network was completely flat, he said, and that he was then able to jump between different business units and business systems, and then he found tons of information that he thought was interesting, and then he just FTP'd it to himself. Okay? Now, the part that I laugh about this is because this type of garbage is so easy to remediate. It's just so easy to prevent this stuff. So first off, why is outbound RDP from every system in the environment allowed? I could make an argument for maybe outbound RDP from a couple workstations might be appropriate. Beyond that, no. So that's easy to fix. Number two easy to fix is the Windows firewall policy on every system in that environment could have been configured by policy to not allow RDP connections except from the management subnet. And then thirdly, the flat network foible. Now, I've published extensively on this whole topic of how it is one of the most brain-dead things you can ever do is to have a single big subnet and have all of your little devices on it. So if you actually have a flat network, this is one of the most harmful things that you can be doing to your environment. But yet I see it all the time. I mean, people are not keeping printers away from everything else. They're not keeping servers away from everything else. They put their voice over IP phones on the same network as their PCs. You know, I mean, they do stuff like that. Now, some of it is just, in some cases, I see it because the people didn't know any better. But this is one of the reasons that you have to educate yourself and know that things can really get a lot more secure and very easy to secure if you simply restructure your network to networking standards and best practices that have been known to all of us for the last 20 years, which is that don't put all your parts and pieces on the same subnet. I mean, I can remember 1995 organizations that I was working with were not doing flat networks. I mean, this is not a new concept. And still to this day, I continue to see regular examples where segmenting your network and then having ACLs in between those subnets to protect the devices on one subnet from the devices on another subnet, that approach in itself is an extremely powerful mitigation factor. Do we do that in residential scenarios? You betcha. Absolutely. You can if you've got a correct perimeter security appliance in there. You will never be able to achieve security if you're using consumer-grade garbage equipment. It just isn't going to happen. And so much of this is about technique, though. What technique are you using in terms of configuring these things? So please keep in mind that just because something has the appearance of working doesn't mean that it's right. All right, so the next scenario was an insider threat sort of scenario. And this was literally a matter of a malicious IT person had managed to get a friend of his to supply him credentials to the email journaling system. Now, I have to tell you that I have a particular antipathy towards email journaling systems. I think that if an organization has a need to be able to determine, do email tracing and stuff like that, then there are better ways to do it through email journaling, such as legal hold is a prime example of the right way to do it. Legal hold is a viable technique where it retains the email, it keeps it in the mailbox, and it has a full audit traceability log as to who has attempted to access things. Now, on the other hand, journaling is a way where all the email sent from and received by anyone and everyone in the entire organization is stuffed back into a central database where it's just anyone who has access to that is then able to get into everybody's business. And I mean, I hope you can see how horrific of a stupid idea that is. So anybody who's ever asked me about, like, well, but we want to use journaling, I'm like, well, really, what business requirement do you have to use journaling? Are you really talking about you want to have legal hold? Because there's better ways to do it other than journaling. And so, sure enough, simply because this company had this silly idea that they had to have journaling for all email, what they ended up doing was having a massive insider breach from a disgruntled employee that had access. The next insider breach example was this is actually pretty darn funny, but also highly easy to remediate or and prevent. So there was an engineer who was a programmer. He's a software programmer, and he had literally outsourced his job to a foreign company. He took his multi-factor authentication key fob and mailed it to this foreign company that he was outsourcing his job to. And he'd come in every day, he'd show up for work, and he'd just sit there and goof around on his computer all day while this other company was literally VPNing into the corporate computer system and doing his job for him from the programming perspective. What was really funny was that these guys actually wrote good code for him, and he was consistently considered to be, like the best developer in the company and everything. Well, obviously, they fired him once they found out about this. And the thing is, in terms of mitigating this risk, it would have been as simple as having GeoIP blocking that would have rejected connections from unauthorized sources, right? So if you're going to have a corporate VPN where your employees can connect and gain access, hey, it's great that you're using multi-factor authentication. Double thumbs up, big kudos on that. But then let's prevent VPN connections from places where your employees can't be. Okay, if they're, if they're in Antigua, and you've got an office there, well, that's one thing. But if they're there in Antigua on their vacation, they shouldn't be VPNing in anyways. So the question you have to ask is, do you need connections from Antigua? I would say that the answer is probably no. So then just GeoIP block that and solve that problem, with regards to remediating or minimizing your risk further. Now, well, you could say, well, okay, but the bad guys can just like rent a server from Rackspace and go wreak havoc. Yeah, they can, and they do, which is why you have different techniques for dealing with those issues. But this GeoIP blocking capability is just another fine example of literally how easy it is to have a piece of functionality that can dramatically reduce the risk profile, both for inbound attacks and for outbound data leakages. Well, that's it for today's show. The next show is going to be part two of this, since there's just so much to learn from it. I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King.